Hello, and welcome to the Mosaic Portland podcast. Mosaic exists to follow Jesus in authentic community for the world. We come together on Sunday as one church in two locations in Northeast Portland and North Portland. Come join us at one of our gatherings. For times, how to find us, and more information, visit our website at www.mosaicportland.org. We look forward to worshiping with you. Here's this week's talk.
Well, hey, good morning, you guys. How's everybody doing? We got a new cross. Did you guys see that? I'm told that this cross is was original to Portland Alliance Church, which housed this building, was met in this building for decades before Mosaic was planted, and that makes it probably pretty old. I don't think it's the cross that Jesus was on, but it's pretty old, and it's cool. I hope that every time you look up there and see that cross, that you remember what Jesus has done for you, and that you remember that this is the kind of place where we come and we admit our need. We openly admit that we are people who don't have it all together, but that we serve a God who does and who's given his very best for us. That we could be that kind of a community in our city, and we can invite as many people as possible to be a part of that with us. We're in 1 Peter, and we're going to be looking at chapter 1, verses 13 through chapter 2, verse 3. And I want to tell you a little story. I want you to think back to last spring. If you can remember warmer weather, it actually is kind of a happy place to go. So this is a happy story. It was a warm spring day, and Jenny decided to take her dog for a walk. And so she went out on a walk, and she was a few blocks away from her house, and she saw her neighbor was having a yard sale. So she thought she would stop by, and she did. And it was your typical Portland yard sale. Some old picture frames, some old books, some assortment of dishes, some very random tools that probably hadn't been operated for 20 or 30 years. And as she was looking around and walking her dog, and she noticed leaning up against a table an old bike. The bike was a mess. The bike was dirty. It was corroded. It actually looked like it had been a piece of yard art for some years. And it was a mess. And Jenny took a closer look at the bike, and she saw that bike could actually be fixed. And then she noticed that it was a classic brand. That this bike could actually be turned into something very cool and very usable. And so she asked the guy sitting in the driveway, she said, "Hey, how much is that bike?" And the guy looked at it and said, "That old thing? I'll give it to you for $10. And Jenny is hiding her excitement. She quickly pulls out her wallet and gives the guy $10 and wheels the bike to her house. And when she got it home, she started a process. She started to make this bike something new. She cleaned it. She replaced old parts. She added features to it. And by the time she was done with it, she had this very cool, very classic commuter bike. And one day she was out riding her bike, and she rode past the guy who sold it to her, rode by his house. And he waved her down. He said, "Hey, any chance I could have that bike back?" And she said, "No." She was nice about it, but she said, "No." And she was right. She paid the price for the bike. It belonged to her. It was her bike. And she had renovated it and restored it and made it what it was. And she declined. And here's the good news: if you're a follower of Jesus, you're like that bike. You're like that bike. You have been bought at a price. Jesus paid that price. That cross reminds us of the price that he paid. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. Kind of unpack this. This is sort of the key verses of what we're looking at today. It says, "For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Jesus, a lamb without blemish or defect. It says here that we've been redeemed or purchased. We've been liberated. We've been made free. Jesus paid the price for that freedom, for that liberation, for that redemption. Just like a person who had enough money could actually go buy somebody who had been a slave and could actually pay that owner and then buy that person's freedom. Jesus has paid that price for us by shedding his blood on the cross. And as people who now belong to him, he is remaking us. He is remaking us for his purposes. Just like Jenny did with the bike. Yet in our city, we have a lot of temptations. Temptations that lure us away from the renovation that God is doing in our lives. We feel pressure to fit in. We feel pressure to conform. We're tempted to pursue the security and the pleasure that everybody around us seems to be pursuing. But God says, that's not why I bought you. That's not why I bought you. He says in 1 Peter to Christians who had been scattered from their homes, these people are foreigners, they're living in a strange land. He says to these people, he says, I bought you for a different reason than for you to fit in. As Christians, their lives were in conflict. They were at odds with all the norms and the expectations of the places where they lived. But Peter is writing to them, and he's telling them to embrace the reality that they're aliens and strangers, and instead to live out the purposes for which God has redeemed them. So here's the question we're going to try to answer today. How do we live redeemed? How do we live as redeemed people when there's constant pressure to conform? Peter gives us a three-part answer. First, he gives us a proper understanding of who God is and what God is doing. It starts with a proper understanding, a correct understanding of who God is and what he's doing. And then the second thing he does is he gives us a new motivation for living out God's purposes in a city where there's constant pressure to conform. And then third, he tells us what it looks like to live as redeemed people. He gives us a picture of our purpose, how this actually plays out, what we actually do as redeemed people in our city. Let's look at verses 13 to 16 and talk about this first thing, to get this proper understanding of who God is and what he's doing. Verses 13 through 16, chapter 1 of 1 Peter. Peter writes, "Therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, 'Be holy, because I am holy.'" We need a proper understanding of who God is and what he's doing if we're going to get anywhere in living this life as redeemed people. And the first thing we see here is that God is holy. God is holy. Our understanding of God, if it doesn't begin with holiness, we're starting in the wrong place. Holiness means that God is totally unique. He's totally set apart. He's perfect in every way. And here's what this means, guys. God is not like you. He's not like your friends. He's not even like the most spiritual, holy, impressive person that you know. Yet that's how many of us think of God. And in particular, we think of Jesus like this. It's like, Jesus? Oh, yeah, he's a great guy. Great teacher. But he had his flaws. Studies show that over 50% of Americans think that Jesus screwed up, that he sinned. And that isn't necessarily what we think. Some of us struggle with that, and we think that, we wonder that, and some of us actually believe that. But what I see is we actually just don't quite see Jesus as holy. We don't necessarily think he screwed up or sinned, but we put him like two or three rungs on the holiness ladder, like above where we are. Like two or three rungs. He's not that far beyond us. He's just a little bit ahead of us. And when we do that, it creates really low standards. If Jesus is just a couple rungs above us on the holiness ladder, that means that a certain amount of unholiness is justifiable for me. It's okay to be a follower of Jesus and also a little bit greedy. As long as you're not as greedy as the guy across the street, it's okay, right? It's okay to follow Jesus and be a little bit racist. It's okay to follow Jesus and cheat. A little bit of cheating. Not a lot, but a little bit. See how this works? In fact, if you take away God's holiness, if you take away his perfection, the reality that he is utterly unique, that he is totally set apart, Christian behavior is nothing more than a sentimental way to live. I mean, why on earth would we try to even live as Christians in the world if our God isn't holy? It makes no sense. I'm waiting to have sex until I'm married. What? I mean, that's kind of sweet, I guess. Like, in a horse and buggy, old-fashioned kind of way. It's kind of cute. But it's weird. Doesn't make any sense. Unless God is holy. If God is holy, everything changes. If God's love is perfect, if God's truth is perfect, if his righteousness is perfect, then we have a reason to live holy lives. He is the reason. Because God is holy, there's no room for us to be flippant about sin. There's no room for us to be moral for sentimental reasons. Because God is holy, we're to be holy. As his sons and daughters, we pattern our lives after him. That's who God is. The other thing verses 13 to 16 tell us is what God is doing. Peter gives us a proper understanding of what God is doing in our world and in our lives. God is remaking us. He's involved in our lives. He is actually making us set apart people. In verse 13, Peter tells his readers, he says, put your hope, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you by Jesus. He's talking about a time in the future when Jesus will return and finish what he started in the lives of those he's redeemed. He's going to finish the bike project. Jesus is actually going to come back in the future, and this is hard for us to wrap our brains around, especially when we're thinking about a football game that starts at 10 o'clock. But he's coming back. And when he comes back, he's going to finish the work that he started. He started this renovation process in your life, and he's going to finish that work. He's going to complete it. If you're a follower of Jesus, you know something about grace, right? You know that grace is awesome. You've gotten a taste of it. Each of us that follow Christ, we could sit around, we could tell stories about God's grace in our lives, how he saved us, how he keeps on saving us from darkness. We could tell about how Jesus guides us. We could talk about how Jesus is with us. Now check this out. There's more grace coming to you. You haven't maxed out grace yet. Peter says there's more grace to come. You don't have all the grace yet. God is in this process of setting you apart. And when he returns, he's going to finish perfecting you. The work that he's doing in your life is remaking you. That is your trajectory. Sometimes we go, I don't know what God is doing. We don't know what God is doing in Doug and Anya and in Micah and Lucy. But I can tell you this. He's putting them on a trajectory to make them complete, to make them the people that he wants them to be. And it breaks our hearts, and it's incredibly sad. And it feels like a dream has died for them. We don't know everything that God is doing, but we do know this, that God is loving the Holcomb family. He's making them into the people that he's wanting them to be. Peter is telling us that this is our hope as broken people. When Jesus is finished with you, you're not going to look anything like you look right now. How cool is that? It's the work of grace that he's doing right now and that he'll finish. It's a promise. You might look at your life right now and you say, hey man, my life is a train wreck. What you need to understand, and this is where you need to put your hope, you're not going to end up where you are right now. You're not going to look the way you look right now. I've shared with the community here that I've been in marriage counseling with my wife. I thought I was a pretty good husband up until about 5 years ago. And then my wife told me I wasn't. And it was a shocker. It was like, really? Do you know how lucky you are to be married? You know, kind of deal. And we went to marriage counseling for about a year. And I can say that process has, God has used that process to shape my character. And it's not just affected my marriage, it's affected my other relationships as well. God is making me more holy. He's making me more like himself. And here's what I can't wait for. I can't wait for the time when he comes back and he finishes that work. That's where Peter says we're to put our hope. We put our hope in the work that God is doing. As broken people, as people who don't have it all together, this is something we value. We talk about being broken. We talk about being honest about where we're at and our own need for Jesus. We want to be that kind of a community where it's okay to not be okay, right? But here's the thing. Being broken is not the target. It's not the goal. That's not the goal. It's not what we're shooting for. Can you imagine somebody, you know, hey, what did you do at your church thing today? I sat around with some friends and we cried about how horrible we are and how horribly we've been wounded. And we're going to do it again next week. You should come. No, that's not who we are. We're people of hope, that Jesus is involved in our lives, that he's actually making us holy people. Okay, so that's verses 13 to 16. That's who God is. He's holy, and that's the work he's doing. He's making us holy people. Now, the second set of verses here talk about a motivation. You see, we need some motivation to live out what God is calling us to live out as redeemed people. And verses 17 to 21 actually give us some motivation, but it's not quite what you might expect. Let's look at these verses. It says, since you call on a father who judges each person's work impartially, live out your time as foreigners here in reverent fear. For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. He was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. Through him you believe in God, who raised him from the dead and glorified him. And so your faith and hope are in God. Now, remember that Peter's writing to refugees, right? These guys are foreigners. They didn't enjoy the privileges. They didn't enjoy the protections that regular citizens had. They also happened to be followers of Jesus. And that way of life that they were living, that holy way that they were being called to live, was at odds with their culture. And so it makes sense that they would feel pressure to conform, right? That they would feel pressure to try to fit in. They wanted to feel secure. They needed some motivation then to not conform. They needed some motivation to embrace the reality that they are actually aliens and strangers. So Peter provides them with unexpected motivation. Fear. Did you catch that? Verse 17? Live out your time as foreigners here in reverent fear. That's a hard word for us. There's actually a couple of hard words here for us. Judges. The Father judges us. So we're to live in fear of him. Those are like cuss words in Portland. fear, judgment. I mean, that's like, don't say those things, you know? You get in trouble. Why would we fear God if he loves us? How is it that God can love us and also judge us? Those are some of the questions that this raises. Let's take a look at that. God's judgment in verse 17 is addressed to believers, right? Peter's writing to believers. And so there's something we know about this. We know that those who trust Jesus cannot be separated from God's love. It's a promise. There's nothing that can separate us from the love of God that we have in Christ Jesus. So when Peter talks about God judging followers of Jesus, it's not a condemning kind of judgment. It's not an excommunicating kind of judgment. It's not a, hey, live holy or God is going to kick you out of the family sort of thing. What it is that God will actually ask us to give an account for our lives. There's a day coming in the future when he's going to complete that work, but then he's also going to judge us. And he's going to say, hey, tell me what you did with your life. And then he's actually going to reward us accordingly. Romans, 1 Corinthians, we see this throughout the New Testament. This is what this judgment looks like. He's going to ask us to be accountable. And so here's a serious question for you. Do you want to stand before God and he's going to ask you, hey, what did you do? What did you do with your time? Give me an account. Tell me about it. Do you want to say to him, what I did with my time was make a lot of money and then I bought some really sweet stuff with it? Is that what you want? Do you want that to be your answer? Or this, during the time you gave me in Portland, Oregon, I drank lots and lots of microbrews. Do you want to stand before God and say, you know, I pretty much took care of myself because that was about all I could handle? What Peter is saying here is that how we live now matters forever. It matters now, but it also matters forever. And we need to understand that God is a holy judge, and a very fitting response to him is fear. Awe. Not fear that he's going to condemn us or excommunicate us, but a sense of reverence that scares the selfishness out of us. A fear that humbles us and motivates us to become more and more like Jesus. Without fear of God, we end up working against God. Instead of conforming to him, we conform to the world. Why? Because we actually fear what people think of us way more than what God thinks. And so we begin to work against that renovating work, that work of making holy, making us holy, setting us apart. We work against him in that rather than with him. So God wants to replace our fear of not fitting in with fear of himself. Instead of being scared of what your friends might think of you, live in awe and reverence toward God. See, following Jesus is both tender and awesome. It's both comforting and terrifying. Jesus did things that just scared his disciples. We forget about that. We forget that Jesus would do something like he calmed the storm. There were these waves and wind and driving rain, and then Jesus spoke and he calmed the storm, and it freaked his disciples out. Holy terror. Our response to Jesus, tender, yes, but also awesome. Also reverent. Should be no different than Jesus' disciples. And when we have this sort of relationship with him, when we have this tenderness and this awe, this comfort and this terror, we actually begin to look like the people Jesus wants us to look like. We actually begin to look like that new bike, the redeemed people that he's making us into. And the last few verses here, they actually give us a picture of what that looks like. Look at verse 22 and the verses that follow. Peter says, "Now that you have purified yourselves by obeying the truth so that you have sincere love for each other, love one another deeply from the heart. For you have been born again, not of perishable seed, but of imperishable, through the living and enduring word of God. For all people are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of the Lord endures forever. And this is the word that was preached to you. Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good." What does it look like when we live in love and awe of God? We actually begin to love other people. To actually love other Christians. See, when you gave your life to Jesus, when you first gave your life to Jesus, you experienced a new birth. We call this being born again or a spiritual rebirth. It's different than your biological birth. Biological birth happened when you were conceived, and the seed that conceived you is a perishable seed, right? It's good for about 80 years. It's good for like 80 years, maybe a little more if you drink a lot of green smoothies. That's about how long that lasts on this earth. But when you were born again, you were born of something imperishable. God's seed that gave you a new birth is invincible and it's pure. And that pure seed gives you pure love for other Christians. One of my friends who was baptized up at Mosaic North, he said this in his story. He said, "I used to want to punch people in the face who talked about Jesus." I was like, yeah, shoot. Some of you can probably relate to that though, right? Some of you are Christians and you want to punch Christians in the face. I mean, Christians often act in ways that warrant being punched in the face. But here's what happens when you become one. You actually start to love them. You start to see the way that you see yourself. You're like, wait, I'm messed up. They're messed up too. I need grace. They need grace too. And that love is birthed in our hearts by God's imperishable seed. Now, there's something else here. Peter says that even though sincere love is something that we have, something that's born in us, it's not automatic, right? He's very clear about that. He says that you have this love, so now you have to go be loving, right? There's an action that takes place. It's a choice. When you come into the church and you start hanging around Christians, it's only a matter of time. And man, if you're a new follower of Jesus right here in the room today, I'm so glad that you're following Jesus. And I just want you to tell you, at some point, somebody who follows Jesus is going to hurt you. I wish that wasn't the case, but what you need to understand about the people sitting in this room right now is that we're all messed up. And you're going to get hurt. You might get hurt by a pastor. You might get hurt by somebody in your life group. You might be, I don't know. But it's going to happen. And that love that you have for the church, that you have for the people of God, is actually going to be put to the test. You're actually going to have to choose to act on it. You're not going to feel like it. This is why people bail on church. This is at least one reason why people bail. It's like, I don't want to be around Christians anymore. I love Jesus, but I don't want to be around Christians anymore. That's making the choice not to love. There's a decision that has to be made. We have to act on this love. So love is both the result of our salvation, but it's also the goal. Our purpose as redeemed people is to love. That's what it looks like. And so because of this, we're to get rid of all the stuff that quenches our love for one another. Chapter 2, verse 1, it gives a list of all the things that wreck love. Malice, that's like ill will, harm. when you want somebody to be taken down, that's malice. Get rid of that. Deceit and hypocrisy, these are words, these are about lying, they're about putting out a false front. When you manage your image to trick people into thinking a certain way about you that isn't true, get rid of that. It ruins trust. Peter says that has no place in a loving community. Envy. Envy is when you want something that somebody else has, and instead of wanting what's best for them, that they could enjoy it, you want them not to enjoy it, and you want that enjoyment for yourself. You want what's best for you. Slander. Saying stuff that smears or tears another person down. There's all kinds of ways that we can use our words as a weapon. We can slander people to their face. We can do it behind their back. And these things, Peter writes, need to be actively rooted out of our community. They need to be rooted out of Mosaic. They need to be rooted out of our own hearts so that we can engage in loving practices, not stuff that dulls and quenches and harms and damages our love for one another. This is what this looks like. This is how we do this. And so we look at that list in verse 1 of chapter 2, and there's something important that you need to notice about it. All those things are in play in the real world. On some level, malice and deceit and hypocrisy and envy and slander, those are actually normal and acceptable. They're actually ways that you can get ahead in the world. They're ways that you can conform. They're ways that you can... It works. And this brings us all the way back to the beginning. Don't conform to that stuff. That's not what Jesus purchased you for. He didn't buy you for that reason. He bought you to make you holy, to be loving. As followers of Jesus, we've been bought by his precious blood for a very different purpose. So we're going to take communion, and we're going to remember the price that Jesus paid for us. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're invited to these tables, and when you come, I want you to remember the price that Jesus paid for you, that he gave everything. He gave his life. When you come to this table, maybe today you're feeling some temptation to conform to the world. There's some temptation that's very real for you right now. There's a way of life that you're even thinking about going back to. Come to this table and rethink that. Rethink what it is that God bought you for. He bought you to live in his grace and to be in awe of him, holy fear, and to become the loving the church, loving one another. And then maybe today you just kind of wonder if you've used up all of God's grace. Maybe you're here and you don't think there's any grace left for you. Like you've tapped out God's love. Your own behavior has kind of disqualified you from any more grace. Will you take that bread and dip it in the juice, and will you remember that there's more grace to come? That God is not finished with you yet. That he's changing you just like he's changing me. He's making us into the people that he wants us to be. So let's sing, let's worship, and let's celebrate our God's great love.